Hi, this is Stu Holliday and welcome back to the Focus Mind podcast. It's been a long time since I last recorded anything, and in that time I've been very busy with finishing off what effectively was a PhD. It wasn't actually a doctorate, but in terms of work output it was, and I also have some research that I'm going to be publishing with my professor in the next few months. I really do enjoy actual broadcasting, as I did during the latter part of 2019, where we spoke to Ed Caesar, Sarah Symington, Pete Bromker. It's always been my ambition, after qualifying, to be able to restart the podcast. And after the learning experience that I had, it's just really exciting to think about some of the guests that I've got coming up. Now that I'm on the other side and I'm a fully practicing, full-time psychologist in performance, in sport, business and the arts, I can bring even more interviews to you as part of what I try and do as a psychologist, to demystify what we do in order to be able to share with the public interesting stories and approaches that people ask me about, whether that's friends or professionally. And it's just good fun. I used to work for the BBC in broadcasting when I was a student. I set up with friends the Manchester Student Radio Station. And so it's always been a passion of mine, and now I've got better equipment, better recording. The quality of these chats is also going to be going up, as well as the quality of the chat itself, without me getting too Alan Partridge there for you. But let's just get back to the point in hand, and today's interview is with Pete McLeave. Pete is someone I've known for a couple of years, as you'll hear in my intro. And before we get into the actual interview that I did with him in September last year, I just want to think about, what do I take from this podcast interview with me? I think his example is one to us all, not just in his fight against myeloma and his setting up of the 10,000 Donors charity, but his story of how he had to change his mindset and life plan from what he had originally thought was his purpose and be able to pivot into another direction and answer a different calling. When I work with individuals, we're seeking to understand how their thinking is constructed and how that impacts their behavior and their actions. I've known Pete for over 2 years, and his story, determination and grit are remarkable. As someone who's been through the leukemia journey myself with a family member, I know how draining and traumatic it can be at a human level. There are many lessons from Pete's experience that we can all bring into our life, and I'll let the tape run for you to hear how and let you reflect, take inspiration, and hopefully a small piece of action to support Pete, 10,000 donors and the stem cell register, wherever you are in the world. It is a bit of a diversion away from my usual conversations on high performance relating to sport, business and the arts, but I feel it is just as relevant to my work and ethos of working with people to help them find their focus and stay dedicated and on track to their goals and life achievements. So hi, this is Stuart Holliday, and this is the Focus Mind podcast. With me today, I've got Pete McLeave. If you could just say hi, Pete.
Hi, hi there, Stuart. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And Pete's someone I've known for over a year now, and his story is both fascinating and slightly sad as well, although Pete's ever the optimist, as you'll find out in the conversation we're going to have. The Focus Mind podcast really looks at people who are, you know, leaders in their field, whether that's in sport, in business, entertainment, or just in life. And Pete's kind of covered the bases in a couple of different areas. He's had a very successful career in business, but his life changed on a single moment, which we'll soon find out about. And he'll share his story. But what I'm looking to try and do here is, through talking to people such as Pete, is find out what happens in their with their thinking about their mindset and what they've managed to do so far, and then how life circumstances has changed how they think and how they've developed their resilience, how they've developed their coping and thriving in life. And I think Pete's got all of those areas covered. So I'm going to keep quiet now. And Pete, can you just give a short a synopsis, but covering the most important details about your story so everyone can understand who you are and what you're about?
Absolutely. Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you again. So up until September 2016, my life was as standard as normal as you could get. So I had a wife, two kids, a home, and was really getting into, I've always enjoyed sport and fitness, but was really getting into triathlon. So the pinnacle of 2016 for me came to a head in September of that year when I completed Ironman Wales. So I was fit, as I was healthy, or as far as I was concerned, I was. Yeah. And finished the race. 2 days after finishing the race, ended up in hospital with a heady concoction of pneumonia, sepsis, and Legionnaires, which was unexpected.
Just hold on a second there, Pete. Just describe this. Was this your first Ironman that you'd done?
Yes, the first full Ironman I'd done, yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, obviously, for people who do Ironman triathlons, or people who might even just do the Olympic or sprint ones, when you've actually gone that far, how does it feel when you cross the line? So I'm guessing even the person who kind of is the last one on the day, you know, they've put themselves through the ringer. So to give people an idea what it's like crossing the line when you speak to people in the sport.
I mean, my answer might surprise you, to be honest. I mean, when I crossed the line, I, in my head, I built up my training. So I've been training for this for 6 months in the lead up to the race. Right. And I had to learn to swim properly. I couldn't swim. You know, I just wanted to, you know, do something of significance, and learning to swim was my biggest challenge. And I really did think that crossing the line, I had this idea of I'd be jumping, I'd be shouting, I'd be roaring. And I remember crossing the line and I felt absolutely nothing. I felt totally empty. And it really shocked and surprised me, because, you know, I got the pictures. I was pleased to finish the race, but I didn't feel this rush of elation and adrenaline I thought I was going to get. And it might be down to the fact I was tired. It might be it was a long old day. But I just, on reflection, for me, the race itself was kind of the end of a journey. And the real journey of significance for me was the 6, 7, 8 months leading up to it, where I was in full training mode. You know, I was pushing myself to my limit every time I was training. And in hindsight, that to me was the real challenge. The race was amazing. Wales 10B, amazing. But the finish line was, I felt a bit sad, to be honest. It was like, oh no, I've done it now. Where do I go next? So it's not that I didn't enjoy the end of it when my family and friends were all there. They'd all come to watch me, but I didn't get that buzz. So it was quite a, it was a moment of realization that actually, you know, you can focus on the end goal, but in reality, you can waste a lot of your time focusing on something further down the line rather than enjoying what's right in front of you. And I think I've missed some of that. So I'd really come to enjoy the, you know, 5, 6 days a week training twice a day. You know, that had become a part of me. So yeah, it was a strange realization.
Okay. So just very quickly on that front. So you weren't someone who kind of staggered across the line and felt like all kinds of wrong, is what you're saying.
No.
You felt quite good. And then secondly, it's sort of leading in, you know, obviously you're going to tell us about what happened in the days afterwards, but during your training, obviously, you know, like you said, you're physically training 2 days a week, you're in the pool, you're on the bike, you're running around, you know, like there's a lot that goes on where, you know, you're probably eating for Britain as well. But did you actually do anything deliberate in your mental training, sort of like in any of your preparation and in harder sessions? Did you actually actively do anything to help you get through the training thing that you're thinking, well, this might come in handy as a mental skill or strategy when it comes to the race?
It was through a lot of trial and error, but advice from, you know, experienced people. But I came to realize quite early on that I've always been keen on a challenge, and I've always been, you know, I've always wanted to try and stretch and push myself. Often to the detriment of today. So, you know, just very quickly touching on what I said before, I've always been the sort of person who will sacrifice today, whether that's time with friends and family, for some bigger goal in future. And I've always done that with career, with all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it's worked well in some areas, but it hasn't worked well in others. But I think ultimately, when I've stretched myself in the past, it's always been to see if I could do it. I don't like being told I can't do things, and especially if I'm telling myself that. So when I was in any of the disciplines, swim, bike, or run, when I really did feel that I'd come to what I felt like was a limit, enough people have told me that your body's much more capable of giving more than your brain is, and it's just a case of pushing on through, and then you'll be amazed that there'll be another gear in there. And I'm not saying, I went out, if I was with a broken leg, for example, I was going to keep running. But when I was tired, having that mental capacity and awareness, I think that's what it was. Just because you think and feel something, just because I felt tired and I felt like I wanted to give up, it didn't mean I had to give up. And that in itself was a life lesson for me. And lo and behold, I remember I got to mile 70 on the bike, and I just hit a wall. Everyone talks about a wall, and that was my wall. And I was watching the Garmin, and the miles were not going down. I felt like I was fighting so hard to get to it. I just wanted to get to mile 80, and I knew there was a hill coming up. And I just kept going, and it's literally one push of the pedal at a time. And I would look ahead, and I'd see a tree, but I'm going to get to that tree. I'm going to get to that tree, that bush there. And then I managed to get through those 10 miles, and it was a real struggle. And I couldn't breathe either. I had the pneumonia had kicked in at that point, and I really was struggling to breathe, and that was a problem. But I got to mile 80, and I just thought, right, I've done another 10 miles. I can keep going. And then I'd just come through a place called Narberth, and I could hear people shouting, I could hear music, and it just gave me a boost. And yeah, I think just realizing that just because I felt something, just because I thought something, it didn't necessarily mean it was the truth. And there was always more in there. And that's what really got me through the darker moments, just that acknowledgement that you've just got to keep going.
And has you had any kind of difficult times in training that have kind of prepared you for that moment that you're describing?
Yeah, certainly in the pool, because I really was a terrible swimmer. I could just about do breaststroke, but nothing else. And when you are doing two lengths of a 25-meter pool, and then you have to stop and you're breathing heavily, and you're asking yourself, is it worth it? I can't do this. I can't do it. And then you go from two lengths to three lengths before you have to stop, and then three to four and four to eight, and you start to see the progress. And actually, in those early days where I didn't have the technique to swim or the fitness, those milestones were coming thick and fast. And just taking a step back to acknowledge those milestones was great. And I think having little apps and little trackers to help you see what you were doing before where you are now is fantastic. It really does break it down to small chunks. And sometimes, because when you get to a level where you can swim 2 miles, for example, and you're trying to, find a few seconds, you're not really getting the gains that can give you that motivation. But in the early days, the early stages, you can really see the gains, and you can go from, swimming very, very slow to swimming not so slow. And it re reflects itself in, double digit seconds, and that they can give you a motivation. So just having that information and the ability to reflect on that is a really good thing to have.
So that sounds like you developed a certain level of resilience and mental toughness through training in the race. So you cross the line and you have the moment with your family, which is lovely. But then, as you were saying there, you mentioned about how you were on the bike and you didn't know it at the time, but what you were actually going through was pneumonia. So it wasn't just pneumonia. You said at the beginning it was sepsis and other conditions. So what did you cross the line, you go to bed, what happens next?
Well, that night I tried to go to bed, but I couldn't. It wasn't just aching, there was something else there. And I remember I went upstairs, and my whole family and friends, they wanted to celebrate that, a cake and all sorts. And I just had to apologize and go upstairs. And I went and ran a bath, and I ran the bath, and I just lay on the bathroom floor, and I just tried to sleep, but my head was buzzing, and my body felt uncomfortable, but not, it was different. I still find it difficult to explain, because it wasn't an achy discomfort of my legs are hurting because the muscles are being smashed on my arms. It was just this sense of not being right. I'm not explaining it very well, but it didn't feel right. And then after like 20 minutes on the floor, I got in the bath, and even that wasn't comfortable. I went to bed, and I didn't sleep at all, even though I was definitely tired. I just didn't sleep. And I was,
Did you think this is my first triathlon, first Ironman? Like I've put my body through the ringer, and no one can experience this till you've done one. This is what it's about. Or did you actually sense there's something a bit more wrong here than just post race fatigue?
No, I didn't think it at the time at all. I mean, I really wouldn't have been looking at anything beyond just post-race fatigue because I just assumed this was just how I was going to feel and I'd get over it. But it was just, I couldn't get comfortable. I couldn't, even though I was tired, I couldn't sleep. It just all built up. And it's only because Jenny, 2 days later, I was still feeling this. She was noticing differences. She could see I was struggling to breathe. She could see there was something wrong, and she was going to force me to go to the doctors. And I've got history here. I mean, when I was 15 years old, my appendix burst, and it ached and it hurt a lot. But I thought the right thing to do was ignore it and go to a house party instead. So yeah, I've got track record of being an idiot with my own health. But
Right. So
yeah,
Jenny's your wife,
yes, she is. Yeah.
and she kicks you to go to your GP, and what happened then?
Yeah, so it became very apparent very quickly to my doctor something was quite wrong, and I was literally told to go straight to A&E at the hospital in Chester, which I did. And then a few blood tests later, they stuck me in a ward and said, "You're going to be here for a while because you've got pneumonia and sepsis." And the Legionnaires thing came out of it later. So I then get hooked up to antibiotics and was in absolute agony. I remember waking up one night in the hospital. I'd just been dozing, and I was paralyzed with pain, and I tried to sit up and I couldn't. And the nurse came in and I grabbed his hand, and I just couldn't speak. I just squeezed his hand so hard. I was in that much pain, and that was awful. Really, really was awful. But yeah, lots of antibiotics and great support from the NHS. And 4 days later, I managed to get out. But that was painful. That was weird. I'd never experienced that sort of thing before.
But that wasn't the end of the story, though, was it?
No. I mean, in a very strange way, I sort of credit Iron Man for literally saving my life because of what I'd been through. The doctors were keeping a very close eye on my state, and they'd taken some X-rays of my chest because I was really still struggling to breathe. And they saw this shadow on my right lung, and it looked like it was either fluid on the lung or some kind of scarring from the pneumonia. And they were tracking this over the course of the next 4 months. So in February 2017, so 4 months after that, they sent me in for a CT scan to get a real good look at what was going on because this scarring wasn't clearing. And it was only by fluke and chance that they spotted these lesions. They looked like pock marks on my rib cage and my upper torso, basically, which shouldn't have been there. It looked like osteoporosis. And so they did a full body scan, and these lesions, these little pock marks, were everywhere. And osteoporosis at the age of 39 or 40, whatever I was, really shouldn't be there. So my skeleton looked like Swiss cheese and was being broken down. They then took a lot more blood tests, and it was on the back of that I got the diagnosis of blood cancer, something called myeloma. And I was told that it was incurable, and that if I was lucky, I might see out the next 7 years because of the aggressive nature of this blood cancer. So that's to go from Iron Man to a terminal diagnosis was shocking for me. I thought I was fit and healthy, had a as I say, have the family, had the kids, all that sort of stuff, and then everything's brought into question. So it was from the highest of the high to quite literally the lowest point I can explain to you that I've ever spent in my life.
And I mean, we've talked previously about your background, and you come from the Northeast, and you come from quite a tough family by what you've described. And you grafted, you had a good career in finance, and got to a very good level. You've gone and tested yourself in, not many people go and do an Ironman, but you put yourself through the training, you did it, and then you get this news that you've got an incurable cancer. And I mean, I guess no one in the world is ready to hear those words, but like, given that what I'm doing here with the podcast is trying to understand people's mindset, talk us through a little bit about how the news hit you, and then what you subsequently did mentally to kind of begin to cope and unpick the news and the implications.
So when the doctor told me, actually, because I'd never heard of myeloma, I just said, "Well, do I have to take some antibiotics or do some training? What do I have to do to get over this?" And with a very stern look in his face, said, "No, Mr. McLeod, this is a blood cancer, and you're not going to get over this. There's no cure for it." And from there on, I would say that the 48 hours after that particular conversation were the lowest of all of them. You sat at home, and especially at night, where I wasn't sleeping well anyway. And you've got nothing but your own thoughts to contend with, and it's dark. And I'm asking myself, why me? What had I done to deserve this? You sort of searching for answers, and my brain is quite logical in that, you know, it's usually a cause and effect to things. And you know, I went into, you know, a spiral of self-pity and anger and all the sort of emotions which are not unjustifiable, I think, in that situation. But I'd I guess the sort of the watershed moment for me came where I started to try and take ownership of what was here. I mean, everything was out of my control, and I didn't like that. I'm not that sort of person who deals well with being out of control. But then I was told by the doctor that if I could find myself a stem cell donor, then there was every possibility that I could beat that 7-year prognosis. So all of a sudden, having done a bit of investigation and you know, in searching myself, I had something concrete to sort of hang my hat on, if you want. And I asked myself the question, you know, it was all about why me, and it was very insular and very self-pitying, and that's no good to anyone. The real question I had to ask myself was why not me? And bearing in mind, you know, one in two people are going to get cancer in their lifetimes, you know, that's a horrific statistic we're all facing. And so I'm not special, and I'm not, you know, I can't sit myself on a pedestal aside from other people and say, you know, I don't deserve this. You know, I don't, you know, that's just life. So when I sort of faced up to the question and answered it myself, there was almost a cathartic release from that. And knowing that there was something I could influence in trying to find that stem cell donor gave me something to do, something to focus on. So it was, you know, an unwieldy challenge. You know, there aren't many people out there registered as stem cell donors. But when I found out, you know, it took a simple, nothing more than a simple cheek swab to get people registered, that was me there. And then I had something to grasp hold of, and it gave me control. And I just found a way to let go of those things out of my control. You know, I have to be in the hospital a lot. I have to take a lot of drugs. I'm going to be away from my family. It's going to hurt. That's just life. That's just the way it is. I've let go of all of that, and I made a conscious effort to do so. But those things I can influence, you know, my mindset, my attitudes, my ability to influence my own odds, plus those of other people, you know, to find their life-saving stem cell donor match, that was within my control. So I grabbed hold of it, and I started to run with it. And that's, I guess, where we are today.
Yeah, so wow. I mean, I know that you're whizzing through the story, and I know that through the work you're doing, you've told it many, many times. But for anyone listening, you know, that's quite a profound thing that might happen to them in their future. It might never. It might happen to someone they know. And you know, I touched on the fact that you'd had a successful career, and you were now in a position where you were facing up to a very big battle to get wherever you are now and to try and deal with this. But what happened on the practical day by day? Because pretty soon after you had to stop work, didn't you?
Unfortunately, because I broke my back as a result of the cancer. It damaged my spine to a point where, you know, there's three of the vertebrae basically collapsed on themselves. So I had to have some, you know, some again back in hospital to get them cemented and stabilized. And luckily for me, there were three vertebrae that were not critical to sort of, you know, anything which could have led to paralysis. You know, it could have been a lot worse. So for that, I'm hugely grateful that I'm still able to function and move around, and you know, I've, you know, been able to get my fitness back to a level now where I'm feeling quite good again. But so I forget the question, but you know, ultimately there are lots of things, you know, you have to go through, and you either face up to them or you don't. And I
Yeah, I
guess
mean,
I've
one
tried
thing
to.
I know in the work I do with people is that, you know, we have this tension in life that change is the constant, and yet it's one thing that as a species we're very poor to adapt to. And I think for me, and you know, you're living your life, you're cracking on with what we could have come to with 10,000 donors. You know, one of the success things that I see in what you've done is the ability to pivot. And pivot quite quickly, get your head around your situation and circumstance, and try and use that, you know, emphasis of control and positive can-do approach in order to sort of move forward. So you've broken your back, you're recovering from that, you're not at work. So this moves us nicely towards what you did next. So you've got this news through that you know, you're off work, you've got a broken back. That you don't know when you're going to be going back to work. You've got the news to contend with about being given an incurable disease. You've got a situation where you've got to mentally prepare for treatment and a difficult prognosis. So What did you do next to put all that energy into a different place?
I mean, it was, it all comes down to that choice that I had to make. And I'm not saying, you know, when I speak about it in very, very loose terms, it sounds like I made a very, you know, it was very easy. It wasn't very easy. You know, there were days and nights which were just horrific to try and have to navigate and get through. But there came a point where I just literally, I didn't want to, if I've only got a limited number of, you know, years left, why do I want to waste them feeling terrible? And it was a decision that I made. It was a choice that I made. And so instead of being a passenger, I chose to take ownership of the situation that I found myself in and try not to feel, you know, like I've been slighted by someone. You know, it wasn't that I'd done anything or not done something. It was just, this is life. And, you know, no one's got a right. None of us have a right to a free ride through this life. And I don't think many, you know, not many people get a free ride. So, you know, I'm not the only person. So, you know, when I sort of took myself out of that, I guess, insular mindset and sort of broadened my vision of it, I was able to, like I say, make a choice as to how I was going to take this particular challenge on. A little bit like when I did the Ironman, you know, I, at the very beginning, I didn't think I had a cat and elves chance of finishing an Ironman. I could barely swim, for goodness sake. But you know, having gone through that and completed the race, you soon realize that you're way more capable than you think you are. And, you know, just because this diagnosis is terminal, it doesn't mean that I can't make the most of the situation I have. And I've, you know, I don't judge anyone for the way in which they approach their own, you know, problems, their own situations. But I just think sometimes we're all a little bit too quick to feel sorry for ourselves and really do occasionally need to take on board the reality of life and try and make the best of the situation you find yourself in. And that's what I tried to do. It was a deliberate choice. And finding something that I could influence was important to me. Having the campaign 10,000 Donors, which was just an idea more than anything, it was something that was mine, and you know, it was something which was going to help other people as well. And I think that was important for me because I didn't want it just to be, although the catalyst may have been doing something to help my, you know, improve my own odds, it soon became apparent that there were too many people out there from all walks of life who were facing very similar conversations with their doctors. And it's not right to have the carrot of hope dangled and then wrenched away when you're told that, you know, the technology is there to save your life or extend your life, but, you know, the tools, the stem cells are not there. You know, when I talk about this, I liken it to being given the keys to a Lamborghini and then someone saying there's no more petrol in the world. You know, you've got access to this amazing machine, but you don't have the fuel to fuel it. So making that choice was key to me, and taking back some semblance of influence over my own destiny was quite important. And like I say, I guess I drew upon whatever life experience I had to do that, and acknowledge that, you know, just because I'm feeling something and thinking something doesn't mean I have to. And I have a choice as to how I approach a day and to a certain extent how I feel about that day as well. And that's stood me in good stead ever since.
Yeah, and not wanting to dwell too much on all that triathlon experience and training, I definitely heard you say there that some of the experiences from that were a bit of a reminder to yourself about what you're actually capable of, and a bigger picture than your own internal world. So tell me about 10,000 Donors. Or I mean, I know about it, but for people who might not, explain what you did in setting that up and how it works.
Yeah, so to frame it, so when I talk about stem cells, for people who are listening who may not know, a stem cell is the precursor to every single cell in your body. So before a hair cell becomes a hair cell or a blood cell becomes a blood cell, it's a stem cell. And if you can find someone who's a genetic match, or if a patient needs, in my position, you know, someone to help donate their stem cells, if you're a genetic match, you can donate those stem cells. And in 90% of cases, it's like giving blood, just takes a little bit longer. And unlike donating an organ, you know, you're not losing something for life. Your stem cells will grow back. But if you donate your stem cells, they can grow into healthy cells in a patient like me, and if not cure the problem, certainly keep that problem at bay. And so when I learned that and the simplicity by which you could register and donate, it just seemed like a no-brainer. So I set up this campaign called 10,000 Donors to get initially 10,000 more people registered as stem cell donors. And I started that on the 1st of September 2018. And fast forward 2 years, we've smashed our target. We're up to 85,000 now, over 85,000. But more importantly than that, we've had 15 confirmed matches for patients somewhere in the world. So 15 people who have had the conversation where the doctor says, we've got you a match, all down to the campaign. And, you know, the people who've engaged with it, like yourself, you know, have listened and gone out of your way to do something proactive to help spread the word. You're the reason why we've got 85,000 people on there. And it just goes to show there are more good people out there than not. And people want to help people. People want to help people, and they want to know that they can do something for more than just themselves. And that's how I feel about the campaign as well. The catalyst may have been my own situation, but it's nice to be in a position where I can help influence, you know, other people, influence the lives of other people. And that's what keeps me motivated. It's what keeps me engaged with the campaign and doing what we're doing.
I mean, yeah, the 15 lives, it might not sound much in relation to 85,000, but, you know, the quantity and quality of the opportunity those 15 individuals, their families, friends and connections are going to have, you know, is brilliant. And I mean, are you in touch with any of those people? Have you had any contact with them?
I only know a few of the people who've donated. I haven't. There's a law that says that you can't connect the donor and the patient for a 2-year period. And then only then if both parties agree. So at some point, it would be amazing to be able to see both the donor and the patient come together. But for now, just knowing that they've had that match is enough for me.
And the determination and grit that you showed in your training and triathlon seems to be the energy you put into the 10,000 donors as a project. And I mean, I think calling it a project is doing it a disservice, because it's more a passion and something you really share far and wide. And I mean, with all the other things that you've had going on in your life, it's quite an incredible story in itself. And you've had quite a lot of people in the media and drawn into it. So do you want to just talk through some of what's been happening in the last year since we spoke about, like, the publicity you've got?
Yeah, we've had some amazing support from regional news TV. We've had ITV, and Mel Barham is an amazing journalist who keeps you know, supporting my story. We've had a song in the charts by a guy called Lee Gordon, and he took the lyrics for this song called The Tide that he wrote from a blog that I've been writing, which was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. We drove a car around Europe in the Crumble Rally, a little 200-pound Ford Focus, and raised about £40,000 for the charity DKMS, who was supporting me. And I think overall we've raised over £100,000 for the charity now, which is great. So, you know, we're doing things, and with support from, like I say, ITV, Sky TV, BBC, both radio and news, and the press as well. You know, we've been very lucky to be able to sort of capture the imagination of people through doing these projects. And, and this podcast today, it's just so humbling to realize that people care and people are interested and want to talk about it, because I think when everyone understands the simplicity and the life-saving power that each one of us has to save a life, it does kind of capture the imagination, I think. I mean, it's difficult for me to say, because I don't like to dwell on it from my own personal perspective. I kind of use the campaign a way to disassociate myself from my own situation. I don't really use me as a foil more than anything, I guess. It's about other people who are also in it. And that, I guess, from a personal perspective, I like to be able to disassociate myself. It gives me a bit of a break from having to think about it. But that other people are engaged with it is amazing, because the only way this is going to work is by other people engaging and being proactive themselves. You know, to get the numbers we have is great, but we need millions of people. You know, to get 15 matches from 85,000 people is great, but you can, you know, extrapolate the odds from those two numbers there to understand how difficult it is to find a match for someone. Yeah. But they're all out there. Each one of us has it. And I think when you look at it on a personal level, hopefully none of you or your listeners will ever have to face up to the conversation I had. But you don't want to have that conversation and then be told that you don't have a match because there's not enough people on the register. And there's only 2% of the UK population and 0.4% of the global population on the register. Those odds are terrible, but at least they give us something to go after. What you want is just to, you know, treat it as an insurance policy. You want to know that there's someone out there ready to support you if you need it, but you don't want to be chasing them. You know, patients, to be quite honest, although I'm finding a focus for me, I'd much rather spend it with my family and my friends. You know, if I've only got 3 years left, then I'd rather be using that time a bit more, you know, on a personal level. But then again, that's quite a selfish way to think. And what we're doing is great, but this has an end, you know what I mean? Once we've got 90% represented and a proper diverse base, you know, from all backgrounds, I mean, that's when this has an end. This doesn't have to go on forever, but that it relies upon people to engage and just do that swab, do that one thing. And if you're doing it because it's an insurance policy for you, that's a great motivation. If you're doing it because you want to help other people, that's equally as great. You know what I mean? You can tell people, you can register, and it is as simple as a cheek swab. I swear to God, that's all you need to do. And the donation process is equally as simple.
Yeah, we'll give people the details at the end of the recording so they can donate if they haven't already. I've certainly I've kicked quite a lot of people over time to donate. I mean, the thing that you're saying there that chimes through is, and it may be if you haven't had this happen, but we all have to at some point, is the question of our own mortality and being quite existential about, what it's all about and how are you going to make the most of the time with the people that you're with and what you're doing and your time on this planet. And I mean, as if your story couldn't take another twist, everyone else has joined in with a series of questions about health and what the state of the world with COVID. So how's that actually impacted what's happening for you?
It's made the campaigning a little bit more difficult because we can't go and meet people face to face, but it's just forced us to be more creative. So what I've been doing is, instead of going out to communities or corporations and businesses, I've started giving a series of presentations online. So, you know, using Teams or Zoom or whatever. And I've done a little video with a charity called ACLT, which we're going to be rolling out to colleges and educational institutions as well, just to tell our story and to tell, you know, show people what they can do. So it's just forced us to be more creative. And that's not a bad thing, to be honest. I think it's good to, although it makes things difficult when it comes to face-to-face interaction, there's nothing stopping us from, changing tack and coming up with new ways to engage with people. It's all about communication. And we're very blessed. We're very blessed now. It's very easy to look down upon the negative side of technology sometimes. But actually, when used correctly, it's a phenomenal tool. And that's how I'm viewing this now. You know, recording podcasts the way we are it couldn't be any simpler. You know, doing videos online, it couldn't be any easier. And you know, I've been able to give probably over 40 presentations in the last 3 months now, just all online. So all I have to do is tell, you know, try and sell the story to an organization. And if I can get an in to go speak to them, fantastic. So, and it's forced me to become a better speaker, presenter, which in itself is a nice skill to develop. So, you know, coronavirus is a pain. It's, I've had to be on lockdown like so many people because I'm one of these at-risk patients now. But by the same token, it doesn't stop you engaging. And there are always ways. There are always ways around these problems. And, you know, problem solving is kind of what you have to do when you're in a situation like I am, I guess.
Yeah, that's definitely something from when we've talked around how much you have a view of the world and what comes your way, whether big or small, is like, oh, you know, it's really shit or really bad. But I, you know, I'm, it's something that I can try and get round. You know, you're definitely a glass half full kind of person. And I just wonder when this broke, the COVID situation, did you not, I don't suggest you reveled in it in any way, shape or form, because of course it's impacting and compromising some of the stuff you can do in your health. But did you think through all my experiences, I can, you know, I'm better equipped to handle this emotionally than maybe some people might?
I didn't think that. I mean, now you ask the question, I suspect that, I mean, I haven't found it that much of a challenge in a weird way. I mean, it's difficult when you've got kids because you're having to explain to them why they can't do certain things. But I guess from my own perspective, I've not felt overwhelmed by it. I know some people have. I know there's a lot of discussion around, you know, mental well-being in particular. But for me, quite possibly, now you're asking the question, quite possibly I was maybe a little bit better prepared because of what I've been through. It's just another challenge. It's another hurdle. And I think, like I said at the top, I don't view life isn't something which, you know, we don't get a free ride. It's not supposed to be easy. And actually challenge makes us stronger. I do believe that. I think you push yourself and you soon start to realize that you can achieve more, you can get over more. And, you know, in reality, with my diagnosis, the way I see things now, obviously from a practical level, things have changed a great deal. I'm on chemotherapy a lot, and I'm, you know, there are things I have to accept that I can't do that maybe I would have been able to do before because, you know, I've got a dodgy immune system. By the same token, we are still way more capable of things than we think we are. And whether it's coronavirus, whether it's an illness, whether it's anything, as long as you're still breathing and you're finding a way to sort of get through a day, why not make the most of it? And I'm not saying every day, good grief. I'm not going to sit here like I'm some kind of saint and tell you, oh, look at me, I'm living my best life. I'm absolutely not. I'm still not patient enough with my kids, and I'm still not as efficient enough as I should be when it comes to other things. But and people, you know, it's very easy to say these things, and people come to their own realization at various stages in life. But in reality, nothing has actually changed, you know, with my life. I'm still here. I'm still going. And quite possibly I'm a better person because of the diagnosis. I'd much rather I didn't have it. But my use of time, I'm much more cognizant of, you know, the things I do, the people I spend it with. You know, I'm much more mindful of those sorts of things now, and I try and make the most of it. I don't always get it right by any stretch. No one does. But, you know, sometimes it's good to have a jolt which makes you appreciate what you have. And, you know, if I really do only have 3 years left and I make those the best 3 years I possibly could, you know, there might be something to be said in a weird way that, you know, it was a kick that pointed me in the right direction. But I'll be honest with you, I don't believe it. And maybe my head's in the sand, but I don't believe I only have 3 years left. I don't believe that. I think there's enough going on in the world to give me hope that there are things progressing in the right way in the world of medicine and science. I think I'm feeling fine, and as long as I'm feeling fine, that's a good thing. And and you know, what will be, you know, we're all gonna unfortunately have to face up to our mortality at some stage. I may have to face up to mine sooner than other people, but you know, does that change anything? Only in as much as I'm making decisions a bit more thoughtfully now, I guess.
Yeah, I was just coming to that, and just how you know, you had a strong mindset prior. You know, you've put another layer on top of that, or two or three, with all this that's happened for you personally over the last few years. I mean, is there any key lessons about yourself and how you think and how you feel strong within yourself that you've recognized or developed, would you say?
I think it's something I've said a couple of times. I mean, I haven't got a magic bullet for anyone, because some people will listen and not take on board, and that's fine because life is busy, and I totally understand. I was exactly the same, and I still am the same, you know what I mean? You know, people want to give you advice. I try and give advice to my kids and they ignore everything I say, even though I'm sure it's the right thing to do. But I think one of the key light bulb moments for me was that we really, all of us, every single person on this planet is way more capable than we give ourselves credit for. I mean, in the world of triathlon, you've got Tim Don, who broke his neck and was told he would never ever race again. And then he put himself in a neck brace where he couldn't move his head I think it was 3 months. He couldn't move for 3 months. He was there because that was the only way he might potentially be able to walk again. And then lo and behold, Tim Don is out there competing at Kona again. So,
blimey.
You know, there's a guy who was given some terrible news and he found a way to get through it. And honestly, if there was one thing I would say to everyone, even though you might not feel it, you might be feeling mentally stressed and drained, you might be feeling physically that you're not in the shape you want to be in, you might feel the world's against you. I promise you, from a man who really was so terrified of doing any triathlon, let alone an Ironman, you are way more capable than you think you are. And life doesn't owe you anything. It's on you to do something about that. And it's about ownership as well. And that's an important thing, taking ownership, not falling into a culture which is very easy to try and make you feel that you're owed something. And you know, I'm not going to lecture anybody, but do know that you are more capable. If you can only run 50 meters today, I promise you, if you keep running 50 meters today, next week you'll run 100 meters and then 150. And revel in those little successes or whatever it happens to be. But whether you realize it and do something about it or not, you are more capable right now than you think you are. And I'm yet to meet someone who can't better themselves just through a little bit of self-awareness and application.
Well, Well, that sounds like an ideal place to leave things for today. The sermon is over.
Sorry.
No, this is great. You know, I think people listening, you know, everyone has tough days. And, you know, I hear a lot with the work I do with people saying, oh, I feel, you know, there's people worse off than me. But, you know, we've all got to our own individual journeys and struggles that we're going through. So if people can listen to this and take something from it, then that's brilliant. But, you know, we like to give back, and you're at 85,000. We'd love to see your 10,000 donors become 100,000. Run through, just to close, what people can do if they want to get involved.
Really simple. Go to 10,000donors.com. That's the campaign website. It tells you a little bit about my story on there. About a third of the way down the page, you've got some links to all the global registration points. And if you're in the UK, click on the little palm print, which shows the UK. It will take you to a charity called DKMS. They will send you three cheek swabs to your home in the post. And all you have to do is spend 3 to 4 minutes swabbing your cheeks, pop it back in the prepaid envelope, and then that's you done. You're registered. And it tells you about how you donate as well. It's not gruesome. I know there's a lot of miseducation out there. It's not gruesome, painful. I promise you, I've been through them both. Dead simple, but you can potentially save a life through nothing more than swabbing your cheek. And, you know, at the bottom of that webpage, we've got all the media links, got all the Instagram, the Facebook, all of the YouTube videos and stuff we've done. So I'm open and available to give presentations. They can be as long or short as you want, and I will happily set them up and do all the hard work, all the marketing. All I really need from people is an in to say, please come and talk about it, and I'll do the rest.
Brilliant. Well, there you go. And yeah, we've got listeners all over the world. I know we've got people in Brazil, in America, Canada, Australia, and further afield as well. So if people want to go onto Pete's site at 10,000donors.com, find your country, find the method that you'll get it in the post. And it looks like a lot of the world is having to lock down more. So you'll be in when the swabs arrive and get that back to the relevant organizations. And let's see what we can do to help Pete find that stem cell and for others in a similar position. And all I can do, Pete, now is wish you further success with the good news that you've been recently having in some of the treatment. And thanks for coming on the show today.
I'm hugely appreciative of the opportunity to talk. Thanks, Stuart. It was great to talk.
Yeah, great. All right. Many thanks.
Cheers.
So thanks to Pete McCleave for that great interview. And as I said at the end, please do look into how you can help support 10,000 donors and what Pete is doing. And thanks for listening all the way through the first episode back of the Focus Mind podcast. If you enjoyed this, there are older shows that I mentioned, which you can find on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast of choice. And please, if you do go there, hit subscribe and maybe leave some feedback about the shows, what you enjoy about them, because that really helps boost our ratings. And please look out for more episodes, which will be dropping very soon. Thanks a lot.